Good evening. On behalf of the New York Society Library, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us this evening. I am Carrie Silberman, head of the Children's Library. Today, April 21st, is Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is observed as a day of commemoration for approximately 6 million Jews and millions of others who perished in the Holocaust. Born in Southeast Poland in 1934, Lola Rain was 8 years old when her parents died. Lola's grandmother arranged for her to be concealed by a Ukrainian family, and she spent 7 months in hiding. During that time, her only possession was a beautiful dress her mother had embroidered for her. With author Lois Metzger, she tells her powerful story in the book, The Hidden Girl. I will reserve the rest of the time this evening for Lola and Lois to share their stories. Please join me in welcoming them.
Hello and welcome. As Carrie mentioned, it's Holocaust Remembrance Day, and there are ceremonies all over the world commemorating this day, including a march of 7,000 people to Auschwitz. I want to say a special thank you to Carrie Silberman and Mark Bartlett of the New York Society Library, and Edra Zeisk, who brought me to Carrie's attention, and also say hello to Roy Wandelmeyer, my editor at Scholastic, without whom, and a few friends showed up, an old friend from college, Judy Livingston, and Richard Peck, wonderful children's writer, is here, and say hello to my family, my brother Steve Metzger, my sister-in-law Nancy Novick, my niece Julia Metzger, and my husband Tony Hiss, and my son Jacob Hiss. Thank you all for coming. Yes, they deserve that. So, in Europe in World War II, there were somewhere between 10,000 and 500,000 Jewish children that went into hiding. Now, that's a pretty big range for an estimate, 10,000 to 500,000. And the reason is that no one really knows the exact numbers. Records were not kept of such things, and by its very nature, the whole thing was deeply secret. So these between 10,000 and 500,000 Jewish children were helped by non-Jews who risked their own lives to save these children. And some of the hidden children were hidden in what was called in plain sight. They were showed up on a farm as somebody's cousin. They were placed in an orphanage or a convent, and there they waited out the war. Others were truly hidden, maybe behind a false wall or an empty office, which was where Anne Frank hid with her family, in an empty factory, in a hayloft, in a chicken coop, in a chimney, and there they spent days, weeks, months, or even years. And Lola was one of these truly hidden children. And in a way, this event seems very straightforward. Lola was a hidden girl, 8 years old, in World War II Poland. Then she came to America. She had these experiences, and now she'll speak. But it's actually not so simple and not so straightforward. Her journey to speaking took nearly 50 years. For 50 years, she was silent. She got married to Walter, who was here, and she did not speak about her experiences. She had three wonderful children, and she did not tell them about her experiences. She made many close friends, and she did not tell them about her experiences. So what I wanted to do was read an excerpt from the book about how Lola went from silence to speaking. This is Lola's own words. On Memorial Day weekend in 1991, I attend the first international gathering of children hidden during World War II at the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square in New York City. There are 1,600 people there listening to panels and lectures and attending workshops where they can share their experiences of hiding, experiences that were so solitary and distancing. I meet Jane Marks, a reporter for New York Magazine. She wants to interview me for a book she's writing on hidden children. We sit down with each other. We talk on the phone. She asks me questions. I let the story out. I allow the words to come, the feelings too. Jane Marks opens the floodgates, so to speak, in more ways than one. I cry every time I speak with her. Her book is published in 1993. I'm no longer silent, at least in print. In 2001, which is 7 years later, I get a letter from the, 8 years later, 7 years later, okay. I get a letter from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. They are looking for artifacts, items that somehow survived the war to display in a large exhibit. I decide to donate my dress, and this is the dress that Lola wore when she was in hiding. There's a picture of it on the back of the book, and it's a dress her mother made for her. Amazingly, the dress has suffered no damage to speak of. The white cloth has turned a bit yellow, and there are some spots, but that's all. It's as beautiful as ever. My daughter, Deborah, doesn't want me to part with the dress. I want it for myself, she says. But Deb, I say, it's just hanging in my closet. If I give it to you, it'll just be hanging in your closet. Maybe it's time that someone else sees it. I guess you're right, Mom, she says. By now, Walter and I are living in New City, north of New York City, in suburban Rockland County, New York. I fill out papers for the Holocaust Museum. A woman curator arranges to meet me in Manhattan, only an hour or so away. I show her the dress, wondering what she'll think of it. I can't believe how thrilled she is. The dress goes on display for a year, and not just in Washington, D.C. We travel to many cities together, that dress and I. In one city, at a reception for the exhibit, someone asks me, "What made you decide to give up the dress?" I don't want to answer. I'm with Sarah Bloomfield, the director of the Holocaust Museum. She hands me a microphone and says, "Go ahead and talk." It sort of falls into my lap at that moment, the whole notion that I will speak in public. Well, I simply have to, with all those people staring at me and that microphone in my hand. In the next city, Sarah just hands me the microphone and says again, "Go ahead and talk." My silence, it seems, has been fully broken. And I wanted to mention the website that is also at the Holocaust Museum. The web address is in the back of the book. There's a special section on Lola called Silent Witness, the story of Lola Rhine and her dress. And it displays the dress, it shows how they restored the dress, and there's interviews with Lola. It's really a wonderful website. And as Lola just informed me, it won a contest as the second best website out there, second only to the Baltimore Aquarium. So Lola then began speaking at schools and synagogues, and one night she spoke at a temple in Mahwah, New Jersey, and Roy Wandelmeyer, an editor at Scholastic, was in the audience. Roy didn't know Lola, Lola didn't know him, and he got the idea for a book. So he called me up to work with Lola, as he said, because of my, quote, background. Well, I grew up in Queens, which couldn't have been more ordinary, but my mother had to leave Vienna just before the war for Scotland on the Kinder transport. And my uncle and grandparents ran from the Nazis for 6 years, so the war was definitely in the air, if not right outside the window. And it influenced my own writing. I wrote a novel about my family's experiences, some of the wartime experiences for a novel called Missing Girls, and also for Scholastic, a biography of Anne Frank. So the idea was for the three of us to have lunch, Lola, Roy, and I, and then decide later, privately, whether we wanted to work together. But as soon as I met Lola, I knew this was something I wanted to be part of. And during the lunch, we just started talking about the book, not if, but when we would work together. And I was very lucky. I got Lola at the right time. She told her story beautifully. She was no longer silent. She was full of feeling and detail. And she really opened up Poland for me because I felt I knew a little about Austria, where my family came from. But Poland was a whole new world, and that was fascinating. And I completely enjoyed working with her. And the way we worked together was I would interview her, take notes, my Lola notebooks, first few times face-to-face, then over the phone, and I would write out the notes, read it back, she'd correct me. I'd read it back, she'd correct me. We'd do this over and over until we got it exactly right. And just on a personal note for me, writing a book like this, there's a certain disconnect because you hear these terrible things, and Lola went through some truly horrific experiences, but as I'm hearing it, I'm thinking, okay, that's good. I can use that. Where shall I put that? And sometimes what happened to her hit me later, much later. Long after Lola told it to me, I'd say, oh, that really happened. And one time I had to call her to confirm the exact date that her mother died. Her mother was shot by German police. And the Holocaust Museum has the date in February, but it happened in Purim, on Purim, which is usually a date in March, so I had to call her to correct this discrepancy. Now, I've already edited several books, and usually it's the easiest thing in the world. If something needs correcting in a short story, you call the writer, you say what needs to be done, you make the fix. Just recently, I had to edit a short story about werewolves, and the werewolf young were referred to as cubs, but as it turns out, wolf young are pups. So I had to make that call and do that correction. So it's usually very simple, but this call to Lola was absolute torture for me. And I thought, I have to do this. I have to check this date, but I couldn't do it. And I thought, what am I going to do? I have to call her. And I put it off and put it off. Finally, I called her, and Lola couldn't have been nicer about the whole thing. And it turns out it was in March, so we do have to make that correction on the museum website because they have it wrong. Now, this book, The Hidden Girl, has been out for about 6 months, and Lola's gotten several letters. And I asked her to bring a few just so I could read them so you get an idea of the kinds of things that young readers are sending her. And sometimes they draw things, which is really sweet. So they draw some of the things in the book. So I'll just read a couple of these letters. Dear Lola Rhine-Kaufman, hello, my name is Ashley, and I am in the sixth grade. The reason I am writing you is because my class read your book, and I would like to tell you how amazed I was when we read it. Also, I want to ask you some questions. In addition, I just want to say your book is so good I couldn't put it down. I can't believe how you felt when you were in that dirty barn hole. Also, it was even worse when that family didn't even care for you. How did you survive? I almost cried when I heard what happened. You are so inspirational to me, I could never have done that. You are amazing. That must have been so hard for you to go on alone with no family by your side. Now I think twice about my life and how lucky I am to have good food, clean clothes, showers, friends, a roof over my head, and a family that loves me. Also the things that I don't need, like a TV, iPod, phone, and other things. You have changed my life, and I thank you for that. You also are great because you even wrote a book for younger kids to comprehend so they can listen to your tragic story. Well, I could write so much more, but there wouldn't be enough paper in the world. And then someone actually wrote a poem for Lola, which was very sweet. Brave little Lola, fighting for her life. Brave little Lola, trying to see the light. Brave little Lola, surrounded by people. Brave little Lola, you were so young you barely had a clue. Brave little Lola, you made me glad. You were a little trooper, so very strong. You always moved along. The end. And she wrote, I hope you enjoyed my poem because you are a real hero. Dear Lola, hello, my name is Alexis Ray Lewis, and I'm a 14-year-old girl attending Union 8th Grade Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I have read your book. To be honest, it is the very first book I have ever taken seriously, and I cried, well, started to cry, because that story was very touching. I am sorry you went through such a horrible time. I have been through beatings and a lot of stuff. I would love for us to have contact with each other. Your very appreciating admirer, Alexis. Read one more. Dear Mrs. Lola, I'm a student who has read your book. I felt really sad when you said that everyone that was a long-lost relative didn't want you. Kinda means that your family broke apart. My family is having problems right now, and I'm always sad and depressed. I just want to make things better so we can all get along. I don't want us to split apart ever. Your story touched me, and I really just wanted to cry. If you read this and you have advice for me, because I'm tired of being sad, please write back. I'm very grateful to Lola for sharing her story with me and with the world, and now with all of you. Here she is, Lola Rhine-Kaufman.
Well, to this day, I still can't believe that I'm speaking in public, because if you would have told me that, I would have never believe that I will stand in front of people and speak. Well, anyway, my remembrance begins with the World War II, and I was born in a town in Poland, now it's Ukraine, and it's called Chortkov. And my memories begin when the Russians were marching into town, and my mother and I are in the street watching the tanks and the soldiers marching in. And then shooting starts. And my mother grabs me, and we're running into the first doorway, and we wait for a few hours till everything quiets down. And I knew intuitively that life will not be the same ever again. And this was in 1939, and for 2 years we were under the Russians. But I didn't realize that time that we were very lucky, because they marched into part of Poland in 1941, the Germans. So people were under, we were in 1941 under the Germans, but in 1939, a lot of part of Poland was under the Germans. When the Germans marched into our town in 1941, that's when our trouble really started. The Ukrainians started to harass the Jewish people, And there were bands that marched around, and when they saw a Jewish person, they would gang up on him and beat them up. And that happened to my father in 1941. They beat him up. And since then, he never was the same again. And in 1942, he became very sick, and he died. And in 42, they started a ghetto, and we had to move into the ghetto. Luckily, our house was just the beginning of the ghetto, so we did not have to move, but people started to sense that bad times are coming, and everyone started to look for a hiding place. And when the first action came, which we called Akcja in Polish, it's action means actually when the trains were in the station and they started to round up Jewish people and fill up the trains and take them to extermination camps, either to Auschwitz. People from our town, they took to a camp that was called Belzec. Well, the first very big action was in 1942, and my mother found a place. We had, like, in our courtyard, an old barn. Also, it was a place where they kept a lot of old furniture from the court, from the people that lived around that courthouse. And the back wall of that barn was made out of wood, and it was plastered with mud and straw. My mother was able to move away the bottom board, and there was a very narrow space between the house, the house that bordered that barn, and the barn itself. It was very narrow. We had to crawl in underneath, and we were only able to stand. You couldn't even turn around. And during the night, you heard a lot of glass breaking, people crying, shooting. It was a very, very frightful noise. I just see my son walked in. Anyway, they started to bang at that wall, the Ukrainian. Most of the people that they were rounding up people was the Ukrainian police, and once in a while you saw a German soldier. They started to bang at the wall because they thought perhaps there's something in back of the wall. And I was just on the verge of screaming when they started to bang at that wall. And my mother put a very heavy hand on my mouth. She almost choked me not to scream. And they started to bang, and the dust started to fall on their faces. And they said, "No, there's no one there." So they left. And it was unbelievable how frightening that it was, especially for a child. When I think about it, I still get goosebumps and start to shake sometimes. Anyway, when they finally left, we waited out till it got very quiet. We spent the whole night there, and the following morning, it was very quiet, and we crawled out. After that action, two of my uncles were gone, six of my cousins were gone, only my mother, my grandmother, and I were left. And just life went on in the ghetto, and it was always hunger, fright, always rumors going around what's going to happen next. In 1943, my mother went to work. She was working for Gestapo, fixing clothes. That's how she was making all the dresses, and she embroidered them for me. She had papers to leave the ghetto. It was a holiday, Purim, on March 1943. She left the ghetto, and on the way to work, she was stopped by a Gestapo with his dog. He was making his rounds. She, her cousin, and two other women, they were stopped. They showed the papers that they were allowed to leave the ghetto, but that didn't help. He took them to the courtyard of the jail, told them to disrobe, and just shot them in cold blood. When we found out that my mother was gone, my grandmother had a big talk with me, and she said to me, first thing she said, I'll take care of you, don't worry, and don't forget that every Purim, when you live through the war, and I remember distinctly, she did not say if you live through the war. When you live through the war, don't forget you have to light candles for your mother. And I lived with my grandmother for just a few weeks. I don't know exactly. I was not aware of the time, whether weeks went by or a month. But it was very shortly after my mother was killed that she, one evening before I went to sleep, she says, tonight you're not going to sleep home. We have to have a big talk. I made arrangements for you to go out of the ghetto. You have to sneak out of the ghetto. You have to walk over to the bridge. The bridge separated the ghetto from the rest of the town. You have to wait there for a Ukrainian woman, and you have to go with her, and you have to be a very good girl and listen what she tells you. Of course, I started to cry. I didn't want to leave her. And she says, no, she's not coming with me. I have to go alone. So I said, well, can you at least come with me to the bridge? She says, no, because we cannot be seen. No one can see you. Well, reluctantly, I did have to leave her. She gave me a little bundle of clothes, and she gave me a little tin cup that my grandfather made. He was a tinsmith, and he made this cup from tin, and he had a double bottom, and he put some money into it. And they said, my grandmother said, when an emergency comes and you need the money, you break it open and you'll use that money. But nobody has to know. Well, I finally left the house. I was very, very frightened. And I had to walk close to the buildings. If I heard some footsteps, I ran inside into a doorway. And finally, I got to the bridge. And I hid under the bushes in the bridge, and I was waiting if I hear something. And needless to say, I was very, very frightened. I didn't know from one minute to the next what will happen. And I was just hoping that this woman doesn't show up so I can go back to my grandmother. But eventually I heard footsteps, and when I look up, I see this Ukrainian woman with this kerchief. This is how they dressed, and in a long skirt. And eventually I crawled out from under the bushes, and I approached her, and she said yes, she was looking for a little girl that she was going to take me home with her. So we are very careful to make sure that nobody's watching the bridge, and finally we're all over the bridge, and if we were caught, the two of us would have been shot. And if we walk for a few miles, I get to her farm, and she is living in this small house with her daughter and son-in-law. And they take me into the house, and they live in just two rooms, one big room, one kitchen, and there was a very narrow room in back of the large room, and there's just wide enough for a cot. And she says, this is your bed, and you have to stay on that cot, and when you hear the dog barking, you have to run in right under the cot and hide. And the son-in-law, I was very scared of the son-in-law. He was very verbally abusive of me. He called me a dirty little Jew, and on account of you, we're all going to be killed. Well, whenever I saw him come back from the fields, I just ran under the bed and just laid there till he went to sleep. And one day, it was on a Sunday, because they worked 6 days a week in the fields, a family walks in, and I'm in the big room, and the dog doesn't bark. And this family walks in, and I knew that I'm in trouble, because they all spoke Ukrainian among themselves. By then, I understood what they were talking, but I didn't know how to speak Ukrainian. And I knew if I have to speak to them, they'll know immediately that I'm not Ukrainian. So who else could I be but Jewish? So they talk to me and they say, who are you and what are you doing here? So immediately I said to myself, my God, what am I going to do? And I point to my ears that I can't hear. So she picked up on that, the Ukrainian woman that kept me. Her name was Tekla Aksanchuk. And she says, she's a mute. She doesn't hear and she doesn't speak. And she is just a relative that is a distant relative that came to visit, and I'm taking her right back. So after they left, the son-in-law was carrying on something awful. I thought he was going to just take care of me himself and just kill me. And he says to her, if you don't get rid of her, I'm taking her tomorrow morning to the Gestapo. And we all go to sleep. During the night, I hear somebody's waking me. And this is Tekla Aksanchuk, the woman that was hiding me. She says to me, she points to her mouth not to say anything, and she says to me, get dressed right away. And I just put on the dress that is in the book, that is in the museum. I put the dress on, and we start walking through the fields, and I say to myself, I think she's taking me to the Gestapo herself. And then as she's walking very quickly through the fields, and I hardly can keep up with her. I'm running after her and saying to myself, it can't be to the Gestapo because she wouldn't take me there at night. Maybe she's taking me back to the ghetto to my grandma. And I wish it was true. I didn't realize how bad it would be if I would end up in the ghetto again. Eventually, we're on the outskirts of my town, Chortkov, and we go to a barn, and she tells me to get into that barn, and I realize that she's not taking me to the ghetto, and we're in that barn, and her sister is going to wait for me and take me in. And in that barn, there's a vegetable cellar, and they tell me to crawl in there, and in that cellar there's a hole, and there's planks of wood. They take the planks of wood away, and they tell me to crawl in into another hole. And as I crawl in, there are other people, a woman called Rose and her brother, and she has a little girl about 3 or 2 years old, I don't know exactly. I know that she's younger than I am. And as I crawl in, I think to myself, my God, I'm really going to be buried alive, because it was a hole dug in a cellar. So we're like very deep in the ground. And the place is maybe 6 feet by 6 feet, very tight. And this is where I spend the next about 9 months in that hole. We have very little food. We are in the dark. Only when their food comes, we light a candle. Also, we had to be a lot of days very quiet because Anna, the woman's name is Anna, and she had boarders. And some of the boarders are sitting outside the barn and studying and talking, and we had to be very quiet because it was right over our hole. And also, we got very infested with lice. They took scissors and they cut all my hair off, and most of my preoccupation in that hole was cracking the nits that the lice lay. And constantly I was on the seams. It's like I was taking revenge when I cracked some lice and killed some. They were going out on my face. It was like a relief on my I took my anger out on those lice. Well, eventually Anna tells us that the Russians are very close. And we also hear artillery and bombing, and we knew that the Russians are very close. And in March of 1944, the Russians marched in into our town. And Anna comes and tells us that we're liberated. And not realizing it then, we were very lucky because we were liberated the beginning of March because we were very close to the Russian border. Well, but Anna doesn't want us to leave during the day. She was afraid that her neighbors shouldn't know that she saved Jews. She was, even after liberation, she was afraid. And by the way, I failed to tell you that one of her sons was a Ukrainian policeman. And if he knew, he would have killed us himself. But her younger son, who was just, I found out recently, that he was just 2 years older than I, he was the one who used to bring us food. And sometimes we couldn't get food because her son, the policeman, was there. So we had to wait till he left to get some food. So one day, very early, maybe 5 in the morning, we left our hiding place and went into our town because the Russian soldiers were there. After liberation, in my mind, I felt that my grandmother had to live through, because who's going to take care of me? I had to have my grandmother at least. And I find out that my grandmother is not alive. And the few people that I knew gave me some food and did not want me with them. Nobody had anything, and they just said to go back to Rose, because Rose is the one that I was hidden with. And then also, after a few days, rumor had it that the Russians were retreating and the Germans were attacking, and everybody thought that they're coming back to our town. So most of the Jewish people were leaving our town and running towards the Russian border. One day, Rose takes me to the window and shows me the road that led out of the town, and she says, "You see, these people are going towards the Russian border. You go out and you have to follow them." And she takes me by my shoulder, takes me to the door, opens the door, and pushes me out and closes the door in back of me. And I just have no choice but go on that road and start following the people. Well, needless to say, I was just devastated. I didn't know where I was going. It was March, it was cold, I was hungry, and at one point I was wishing that I didn't live through the war. And I was thinking to myself, I think my cousins were better off than I was. And as I'm thinking of these thoughts, something came over me and I just passed out on the road. Eventually, when I come to, I am on somebody's shoulders, on somebody's back, actually. Somebody's carrying me. And when I come and ask him, "Who are you? Why, you know, what happened to me?" He says, "Well, I saw you laying in the snow on the road, and I recognized you. I'm a friend of your father's, and I can't carry you for long, but when we come to the first house, I'll drop you off there and see if whoever it is, they'll take care of you for a while." And as he's telling me this, we reach a house. He goes into that house and he tells the people that he's going to leave me there and that they better take care of me, because when he comes back for me, if I'm not there, he's going to tell the Russians about it. And as he's talking to them, the doors opens and Russian soldiers walk in, and I know there was a captain among them because they are addressing him as captain. And he tells them that he's leaving me there and that he can't take me with them. And the soldiers say, "It's okay. They are here with a truck. They're going to take me." And they take me, and we go on the truck with, I go on the truck with them, and they take me to the next town where all the rush, the people that were running, were going to that town to the border because they wanted to get into Russia because they didn't want to wait till the Germans come. Anyway, we get to that town. I stay with the Russians. They put up a cot for me. They give me food, and they were very good to me just for a few days. And then they have to go on with the front. And I end up being in a strange town all by myself in the streets. And I walk around, and I bump into a man that I know. He was my uncle's brother-in-law. And I ask him for some, if he has some food, because it was a few days went by, and I really had no food. He says to me, and it was the truth, he says, I have no food. The only thing I can tell you to do is just knock on the door. You have to go and beg for some food. And that was like just a terrible thing for me. And I really walked around till I worked up some courage to go in into a house and knock on the door and ask if she had a little food, this woman. She gave me a piece of bread and some milk. And I went like this for a few days. I had to go from house to house and beg for food. And I slept in one of these centers on a staircase, sometimes in a doorway. And it was really, I just really didn't know what to do till a Russian soldier approached me and said to me, I was watching you on the streets all by yourself. And I am going the next day to Kiev. And if you will be here the next day, I'll take you to a orphanage. So the next day he comes, and I go into his truck, and he takes me, and we're in the truck for a few hours. We're driving, and then he drives into a little town called Gritsev, and he tells me that he's got to stop. He cannot take me to Kiev because he got orders, and he doesn't know what to do with me, and he's taking me to the mayor of the town, and he's going to leave me there. As we're walking into the mayor's office, there's another man comes in, and he listens to what the Russian soldier tells the mayor, and he happens to be Jewish, the man who just walked in. He survived the war being a partisan, and he tells the mayor, he's going to take me. He just remarried, and he has two stepdaughters, and he's going to take me to live with him. His name is Sergei. So he takes me, and his wife agrees to take me in. And I live with them for about a year and a half. But that year, I think I spent that year being in shock. I know that for a year and a half to live with someone, you have to go to school. And I know I learned how to speak Russian, and I know how to read Russian, but I don't remember even one day being in school. I cannot remember what I did for that year and a half, but I know that they treated me right, because I would remember if it was anything bad, but I really remember very little, till I know that Sergei was taking me to my town, to a woman who knew my uncle, and she told Sergei that my uncle survived the war. And she asked Sergei to bring me to her, and she was going back to Poland, and she would take me with her to look for my uncle. In the interim, my uncle found out from someone that I'm alive, and my uncle was looking for me. And he found someone who was willing to go for me. And as Sergei is taking me to the train to take me to this woman, actually, it's just amazing. It was just within 5 minutes, if that man would have come later, he would have missed me, and if we would have been on the train to go to Charkov. That man comes in with a letter and shows it to Sergei that he came for me and my uncle sent him for. He takes out the letter and he reads the letter to Sergei, and he says that, and Sergei says, but I'm taking her to Charkov. He says, no, he's taking me to Lviv to stay with him for a few weeks, and after that he was taking me to my uncle. So I say goodbye to Sergei, and off I go with another stranger. His name was Romet Kopet, and he was a friend of my uncle's. So it took us a few days to reach Lviv, and I stay with them a few days, and after that, we take a train to Krakow, because that's where my uncle lived, in Krakow. And as we reach Krakow, when I saw my uncle, I recognized him right away. And my uncle lost his wife and a child. They lived in Lviv, and he lost them during one of the actions. But my uncle lived through the war in Russia, because when the Russians retreated, they took my uncle into the army, and that's how he survived the war. He was wounded during the war on the front, but he survived his wounds, and he couldn't go back into the army. And he went to Asian Russia and Uzbekistan, and that's where he survived. Well, when I get together with my uncle eventually, he remarried, and he has a little girl. She's 6 months old. And we stayed in Krakow for about a year. And after that, my uncle didn't want to stay in Poland any longer. So we leave Krakow, and we go through illegally through the border into Czechoslovakia, and then we reach Austria, and then into Germany, into the DP camp. The DP camp, it stays for displaced persons, and we live there for a couple of years, and my uncle finds relatives in the United States, and we leave for the United States, and I reach the United States. I'm 14 years old at that time. And we have relatives, and I start going to school, and of course life is much better when I go to school. For the first time, I have friends in my life, and I'm beginning to sort of come out of my shell. I was always very quiet, and finally I'm beginning to go to school, read books, and I learn how to work the comptometer, and I find a job very early in my life because my uncle was hardly making a living and I didn't want to be a burden to him. So I tried to help out with the finances and with just, he shouldn't have to worry about how to, you know, to take care of me and his family. And eventually I meet my husband and we get married, and I have 3 children now and I have 4 grandchildren, and needless to say, I finally have a good life. And I just want you all to know that I have a very, very nice life. I have wonderful children and great grandchildren, and it's just great. And I just can't believe that I'm standing here and still talking about it. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer. I just need to take a drink of water. And my husband is here, and my son is here. Yes, Roy.
This is a personal question. You don't have to answer if you don't want to. After surviving these terrible experiences,
You know, I never even thought about it. I didn't have a religious upbringing. My uncle was not religious. I remember very little about religion before the war. I know that my grandparents were religious. I remember my father not being religious. And of course, I do know that my mother kept a kosher home. But I didn't even question my uncle because he was not a religious person. So I just, I didn't miss it, but I knew I was Jewish, of course. And I was very more in the DP camp. They taught us about Israel. I was more Zionistic. I joined a Zionist organization, and I wanted to go to Israel, not to the United States. As a matter of fact, I signed up to go. It's called like Aliyah to Israel. And when my uncle heard, he was very angry, and he, you're 12 years old, he says, you're going to go on your own. I'm responsible for you. And he went and took me off the list. But it never occurred to me to not to think of myself Jewish, but I was never really religious because I wasn't brought up that way. So, but I'm observant when it comes to holidays. I make sure my children know when we all get together, but I don't keep a kosher home. Yes. In 1942, I was 7 years old. I was born in, like, the end of 1934. So I was 7 years old. Yes. I just also wanted to tell you that when I finally took my dress off, it was so infested with lice that it was like it was able to walk off by itself. Yeah. Because I didn't take any clothes with me. When she told me to get dressed, I left my tin cup, and I left all my clothes. I just had that dress, and I wore it for over 9 months. Yeah. Yeah. I'll get to that because it's the people that I was hidden with. Yes, it's a longer story. I just want to answer this gentleman's question. Pardon?
The same question?
Okay. To school where? Well, 14, you mean in the United States, on United States? Well, I thought it was great. And by then, my uncle also, I failed to say, my uncle had an English teacher for me. Since we got papers that we could go to the United States, he hired a German man who came once a week to teach me English. So when I came to the United States, I knew a little English, and I came in July 18th, and the relatives took me to, like, I went to some distant cousins for 1 week, and the other one took me another time, and they didn't know how to speak Polish, and they didn't know how to speak Yiddish. So I had to speak English with them. So by the time September came, I knew English, and I spoke English pretty good. So as a matter of fact, we lived on the east side, and I went to Seward Park Ice High School on Grand Street near the Lancy. Maybe you know the east side. And they had a lot of European children, and they gave us a test because they didn't have room for all of us. So they took me out, and I went to regular English right away. And I loved it because I went to school, and I had friends, and, like, I just had a normal life again. Yes? Jewish? Yeah, well,
I personally did not experience it, but I know that there was a city in Poland which is called Kielce, and they killed about 42 Jews. And then my husband is also from Poland, and my husband experienced it, and there were people in the room that he was with that they at night they killed them, and he luckily escaped. They were afraid. The minute they took you away, the Polish people or the Ukrainians came and took your house and took your possessions. So they were afraid that you're going to come back and yet take your house back, and rather than give back the house. They had no qualms about it. They just got rid of you. And this was right after the war. I personally did not experience it because I was already in Russia, because when that man took me, the soldier took me to that town, it was called Gritsev, that was already the Russian Ukraine. So I ended up in Russia after liberation. But I want to go back to your question. I never saw Rose and her brother again or heard from them. In 2007, I saw a paper, a friend of mine showed me a paper from Bergen County, New Jersey, that a Holocaust survivor died a couple of years ago, and he had absolutely no family, and nobody came to his funeral, and they're having an unveiling for him, and it would be very nice if people showed up to his unveiling. And I decided to go because I always feel when someone is alone, I feel sorry for them. So my friend and I went to the unveiling, and I must say about 30 people showed up. It was very nice. It was in February of 2007. And after the services, a man goes over to the rabbi and he says, I'm also a Holocaust survivor and I'm from Chortkov. And I was just stunned. Because this is the town I'm from. So I go over to him and I tell him that I'm also from Chortkov. And we start comparing names, and maybe he knew my parents, and he didn't know anyone. But we exchange phone numbers. And I'm leaving, and he said he'll call me to be in touch with me, and I said, I'll call him. And as I'm walking away, I say, you know, I want to ask you one more question. Do you know anybody named Rose Kalischer? And this is the Rose that I was hidden with, who threw me out. He says, of course I do. Her brother is my best friend. You know, I still get chills when I talk about it. I said, well, I was hidden with them. Didn't she tell you? He says, no. She just said that she and her brother and her daughter were hidden by this Ukrainian woman. She never said she was with somebody else. So I realized that she wouldn't say that because people will ask her, well, where's this little girl? What happened to her? Then she would have to say, either make up a lie or say that she threw me out. Anyway, so I said, well, do you know where they are? He says, well, Rose passed away, but they're all in Israel. So he says, I said, you know what, when I get home, I'll call you and you'll give me his phone number, her brother's number. So by the time I get home, my phone rings and I answer the phone and it's her brother. His name is Abraham, but we always called him, and he called him also Dolo, it's like a Polish nickname. And it's Dolo on the phone, and I almost passed out. And he says, well, this man just called me, and Abe Morgenstein is his name. Abe just called me, and it was just like unbelievable that we started to talk, and his wife is also from the same town, and she tells me that she remembers me, yet from before the war, I didn't know who she was because I was a child. And we started to talk and reminisce, and then eventually I bring up the subject. But in the meantime, they tell me, you know, we started to talk English, and they don't speak English so well. So they say, well, we can talk Yiddish and even better Polish. So we talk Polish, and they even tell me. They can't believe how I remember the language so well, and I remember things so well. And then eventually we get to the subject of her sister. So I say, well, you remember her sister. Your sister threw me out. Oh, maybe you don't remember. I said, well, I wouldn't say that if I didn't remember. And besides, you just told me I have such a good memory. So anyway, his sister passed away. And then eventually, at the end of 2007, my husband and I took a trip to Israel. We were planning to go to Israel. And I did meet him. And I saw him about a year and a half ago. But this is from March 1944. I never thought I'll ever get to see him. Yes.
Well, did you ever see the Ukrainian people again?
No, but I spoke. Dolo is in touch with them, and they are in Yad Vashem, you know, as righteous Christians, right? And I went, when I was in Israel, I went to Yad Vashem because I wanted them to know that she saved four people, not three. And by then they knew. And also, I got the number of the boy that used to bring us food. I called him, and I'm in touch with him. Yeah, I send the money, and I'm in touch with him. The only problem is that he speaks Ukrainian, and I don't know how to speak Ukrainian, so between Polish and Russian, we sort of get to understand each other a little. But the woman passed away, the mother Anna passed away, so did the aunt that took me originally, Tekla, and I wanted to get her name into Yad Vashem, but Dola told me not to bother because she's not alive, and the son-in-law and all that, she says, forget it, don't even bother. So I never did. Yeah. Oh, yes.
What happened to the Ukrainian policeman?
No, he didn't know that we were. Maybe eventually. I never even asked. But he told me that the boy that was that little boy that I'm in touch with, he says that I think he's in Canada. He ended up in Canada. Yeah, so that's it. Yes.
Have you returned to your hometown?
No, I don't want to. I know that a lot of people that the Dolo, you know, Rose's brother, he went back a couple of times. And I have pictures of him in my town. But I can't go back. No. I went back to Poland with my husband because my husband was hidden. And because my town is not Poland any longer, it now belongs to Ukraine. The borders shift over there. Yeah. So, anyway, so that's it. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you for listening.
Thank you all again for joining us this evening. We do have copies of the books available, The Hidden Girl, if anybody is interested in getting a copy. And you are welcome to follow up personally if you have any other questions or comments for either of the authors. Thank you very much.
Yes.
No matter how many times I speak, I still...
Yeah, sure.
It's so difficult. It's like I'm reliving this whole thing all over again.
Her grandfather's family's from Bialystok.
Oh, Bialystok.
So some,
really?
Some got here, and but aunts and uncles, you know, they didn't make it. But
they didn't make it, but somebody
one
made
it to Israel. One, her great-grandmother, my wife's grandmother, made it here.
Yeah.
And her uncle, one made it to Israel, and whoever stayed, that was it. But,
but I know where Bialystok is. It's a big city. What's your name? Hannah. Oh, I have a granddaughter, Hannah. Do you spell it H-A-N-N-A-H? Yeah, the same way? I don't know. I didn't even think about that. I'll be writing, signing book. Okay.
Thank
Hannah.
You very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye. I have two. One for my friend. His name's Jamie. I celebrate Passover with him every
year.
Jamie, J-A-M-I.
J-A-M-I. I don't want to misspell it.
Can you sign this one for me, please?
Yes, sure. What grade are you in?
We're in fifth grade.
Fifth?
Sahir, S-A-H.
S-A-H.
E-E-R.
E?
E?
Yeah.
R.
I'm just writing the same thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What's your name, Steve?
Theo.
Leo?
No, Theo with T.
T.
T-H-E-O.
T-H-E-O.